Blog Talk Radio.
It's Sunday, it's morning, and we're live. Welcome to Sunday Morning Live, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Good morning, everyone. I'm Isidra Person Lynn, your host, and we have a lot to talk about this morning, so we extended the show, and we'll go as long as we need to get through all the different subjects. Later on in the show, we will talk with a caricature artist by the name of Elgin Bowen, and he's from New York. He calls himself the Subway Surfer, and we'll talk to him about bullying and how he was bullied every day, and he wrote a book about it, and he wants you to use it to help in your classroom or with your students. And then also, we talked to Coach Johnny Lynn. We pre-recorded the interview yesterday. He was just named the cornerback coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. And now, if the Lynn name sounds familiar, yes, he is in the family, and that's why we had access to him. So we wanted to go ahead and give you he was a standout at John Muir in Pasadena, and he went to UCLA. So he's a local guy who played 8 years in the NFL, and now he's coaching. He's been coaching for many years in the NFL, just left the 49ers, but now he's at my favorite team, which is the Philadelphia Eagles. And, man, we have just so much. MC Hammer is a techie, and the Scobalizer interviewed him after the unveil of the HP touchpad, so we have a few minutes with him. And I had a chance to interview the people at Buffalo Wild Wings that just opened up here in the Crenshaw District in L.A., but we won't present that. I did that for another outlet, but I went by Maverick's Flat in anticipation of interviewing them, and we had a chance to talk briefly to the chef. I just want you to hear the list of desserts they have there, and we'll bring you the interviews at some point later. Darlene Dunlow has an entertainment report that is so full of information. I don't want to mention anything entertainment because it's all in that report. And then my first guest this morning is a young man that I found out by just reading through the internet, because, you know, this Egypt thing, it just came out of nowhere, it seems. And when I look at the pictures, it seems like a bunch of African-Americans, I mean, you know, light-skinned African-Americans, you know, chanting and elating and all that. And anyway, I just see that. There's just something that comes to my mind. Don't ask me why, but probably because they favor a lot of people in my family. And so I was able to connect with a young man by the name of Wendell Hassan. Oops, I'm sorry. I got a little distracted there. But this young man, his name is, Wendell, I'm just going to pull you on because I know there's Wendell Hassan. I don't know what I did with your name, but let me go ahead and welcome him into the conversation. The last thing you should ever do is botch anybody's name. Good morning, Wendell.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining me. What's the last name?
Marsh.
Oh, God. It just went shoop, and all my screens were open. Not one of them had your name. Wendell Hassan Marsh. And he is a journalist. He spent 15 months in Egypt?
It was 16. But as of, I was on a Fulbright, and my Fulbright was for 15 months, but I stayed an extra month or so.
Okay, so that's a Fulbright fellowship. And I say, this is a Morehouse man. He graduated in 2009. He's young. You're 23?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And in his time, he's already visited Paris and all different places. He loves language. He studies language. And why did you choose Egypt?
Well, for all of my college career, I had studied Africa. I was a history major when I first got to Morehouse, and did a lot of kind of African studies. I had volunteered in Senegal. I had studied abroad in Senegal. And one of the things that became very apparent to me after kind of studying African history was that, you know, you can't really come to grips with African history without having perspective from, like, the Arab influence. And Arabic, because a lot of the primary source documents that was, like, interested in reading, they're in Arabic, particularly from the time period just before European expansion. So Egypt was a way for me to kind of learn Arabic and to continue my interest in Africa while also kind of expanding my area of expertise into the Middle East.
There is an article in The Root called An African American in Egypt, and in it they quoted you as saying something about Sheikh Anta Diop. You said you were formerly a devotee. What happened?
Well, so I first became aware of Sheikh Anta Diop when I was in high school, just kind of reading books like Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams and a lot of just different Afrocentric, you know, thinkers and writers. And that was very much the foundation of my intellectual development. But having kind of, you know, going to college and read a lot and studied a lot and having lived in Senegal, having, you know, attended classes at the Université de Cheikh Anta Diop, you know, I could, I wouldn't say anything happened specifically, but the most fundamental thing that happened for me was that I realized that, you know, Afrocentric thought is maybe misplaced for the simple reason that the basic definition of Afrocentrism is that knowledge starts in Egypt or, you know, Africa versus Greece. But when you think about it, knowledge starts everywhere, continuously throughout history. And so to prioritize the African role in history is, no, there's no reason to put African history over anything else per se. It's reactionary, you know, it's reactionary to white racist narratives of history that we've gotten, but there's no reason for us to react and do the opposite thing just
well,
to kind of get
now,
back.
I would like to invite you right now back in the future and we'll deal with that, but today we're here to talk about Egypt because one of the friends that you quoted, you said he was a disgruntled friend who was at this party that you were at, and
mm-hmm.
He was saying, I'll show you the real Egypt, and he wanted to take you to Nubia or a place. Maybe you could explain that whole party and your friend and what
sure.
his disgruntledness
yeah, so
was, because I think that leads to Egypt. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I said I think that all leads to what we're talking about with this whole Egyptian freedom, but go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mustafa is a friend of mine. Talked to him a couple days ago still, but I met him through some Sudanese friends that we had in Cairo. These were kind of young Sudanese, some of them refugees, some of them guys were just kind of working and studying in Cairo. And so I guess you could say he was a part of kind of the one of like the black crowds who go out to different international parties. And so I met Mustafa a while ago, or, you know, when I went to Egypt. And that particular night, I had known him for maybe about a month. And I don't know why he kind of decided to get on this topic, but we were all talking about, you know, history and, you know, ancient Egypt, pharaonic Egypt. And he was just saying that the people that, you know, we saw in Cairo, they weren't the pharaonic Egyptians, and that the real Egypt was, you know, of course, further south. So
and that's
that
why during
that,
this whole
that,
period, we keep hearing about Egypt. We never hear it in Africa. It's always in the Middle East. And so the quote-unquote real Egyptians, are they feeling – is that part of what he was feeling? Or
well, I don't think we can say – one of the things I tried to get to in my article is that it's unfair to say that, you know, the – people in Cairo aren't real Egyptians. You know, the Arab invasion swept through Egypt and most of North Africa by the 7th century, you know, after the birth of Christ. And so no matter what, they've been there, you know, what, 1,600 years or so. So, you know, I don't know if you can't say that it's not theirs at this point, you know.
No, I see what you're saying, but I was wondering if that's what he was thinking. So anyway, he takes you to... his homeland, and what did you see there?
So I went to his village of Alagi, which is near Kamumbo. There's a big temple in Kamumbo where it's near, and kind of maybe an hour away from Aswan, which, you know, people might have heard of. Mm-hmm. And I went for a wedding, and, you know, all of his cousins and relatives and friends, you know, they were definitely, you know, they were Nubian, they were black, and I actually stood out for, you know, being lighter than everyone else. And it actually, everything about it reminded me of my time in Senegal, whether it was the different customs and how people kind of interacted with each other. It was very similar. And it was, we were down there at the wedding, and there was, I just kind of assumed that everyone was Nubian, quote unquote. And actually, they weren't. They were Arab. The people in one particular village we went to, and it kind of perplexed me, because I said, you know, I thought all you all in the South were Nubian. He's like, no, they're Arabs, he said, and he put in air quotes with his fingers. He said, they're Arabs. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, well, you know, they're like mixed. You know, their great-great-great-great-grandfather, one of them was Arab or something. They came from Saudi Arabia. And I said, well, I don't understand. He's like, well, you know, you can be black and Arab, but they a lot of them think they're just Arab. And so, you know, it was this really kind of perplexing thing, but the best I could kind of see it is that in America, where you have, like, the one-drop rule that makes you black, in Africa and the Middle East, it kind of goes the other way. Like, one drop of Arab blood makes you Arab, almost. And so
it's amazing. It's totally amazing. But can we go back to Egypt now?
Sure.
I wasn't even paying attention, okay, to be honest. You know how you see stories and you're not connecting the dots or whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're calling for Mubarak to step down, and he actually steps down. And I'm always thinking, oh, that's a ploy. He's not going to step down. He gave power to his assistant and or his vice president or whatever. And, you know, he was going to still sit there and watch everything. And then they were like, oh, hell no, we're going to go ahead and get you out. And so then something happened, and he actually left. But what brought us to that point? What was happening in Egypt? You left shortly before all this started happening, but you saw it building.
Yeah, definitely. I you know, it's been building for years. Mubarak was in power for nearly 30 years, but really since the early 90s, when you had structural adjustment programs, the government stopped providing services to its people, stopped providing social services, stopped providing, you know, professional opportunity. However, at the same time, the country was seeing economic growth. You saw a lot of people, some people getting very rich. You saw multinationals coming in, making a lot of money, but it just not trickling down to most of the population. So by the time you get up to the last 2 or 3 years, particularly the 2006, you have something called the Kafaya movement, which means in English enough, you know, like that's enough. And you saw the first time someone actually ran against Mubarak in 2006 was Ayman Nour. And even though he did horribly in the elections because it was rigged, and everyone says it was rigged, and then he was put in jail, Ayman Nour. And since 2006, it's been kind of a crescendo of opposition activity, worker strikes, just protests of all sorts. And then, you know, the last year, it had really been building up. And when Tunisia happened, when Ben Ali in Egypt fled and went to Saudi Arabia, you saw a lot of voices. You heard a lot of voices in Egypt saying, Tunisia is no greater than Egypt. Tunisians are no greater than Egyptians. And if they can get rid of this dictator from 23 years, we certainly can get rid of Mubarak, who's been in power for almost 30.
Wow. Wow. So that all led up. And then what made you come home? It was just the end of your time?
Well, it was the end of my time, and I had actually started working in Egypt as kind of teaching history and teaching literature for about a month and a half. But then I got a few opportunities that came available in Washington, D.C. So I said, hey, let me grab this. Little did I know that if I would have stayed, I would have had a huge opportunity as a journalist. But, you know, sometimes it's not your time. Sometimes it is. So.
But those were dark days. Some of those you could have been beaten or you could have been mistaken. Those of you who would like to see what Wendell looks like, if you go to SundayMorningLive.net or if you're at the show page, he's the very first image that comes up. He has a very interesting website. It's called how do you pronounce that, The Afrabian?
Yeah, TheAfrabian.com.
Okay. And so why did you name your website that?
So the Afrabian, that word comes from a Kenyan scholar by the name of Ali Masri. He is a brilliant thinker, a brilliant writer. He works he's a professor at the University of New York at Binghamton.
Mm-hmm.
And he does kind of political theory, history. Like I said, he's Kenyan. But basically the idea of Afrabia is looking at Africa and the Middle East is more unified than separate. It's really a repositioning of the geographical imagination. He stresses that for the future of both Africa and the Middle East, that we should start looking at them as being more connected than separate. So I'm using kind of this concept. Not because I think that, you know, that relationship is a historical one that shouldn't, I think that it's a historical relationship that has a lot of issues and a lot of problems,
mm-hmm.
but it presents a way to look at African and Middle East that challenges dominant perspectives on what we can say the global South. You know, of brown people of the world.
If you'd like to call in and talk to Wendell Hassan Marsh, that number is 619-996-1674. It's right at the top of the show page, 619-996-1674. We only have him for a few more minutes, and I just find it very interesting. I love the fact that you used your formal education to kind of get out into the world and see and develop all your points of view and meet all these different people and find out all these different points of view. Now, in Egypt, I noticed in one of the articles you said something about color. We were talking about color earlier, but you were saying that the lighter Egyptians will tell you there's no racism, but the darker ones have a different point of view. And by you being lighter, and a lot of the lighter, in other words, when I see those people on the news and they're chanting and they're doing this, they kind of look like you and my family.
Yeah.
And so people speak around you freely because they assume you think like they do. What were they saying?
Yeah. Sometimes they'll speak way too freely. you know, they would have comments, calling some black Africans Abd, which means slave, or Samara, which, you know, like it's like means like blackie, or really kind of pejorative words. Or there was a nightclub in Cairo. It was a kind of a hip hop nightclub, and me and friends would go there a lot. And one time, the guy who kind of manages there, he had kind of cracked a joke to me and another Egyptian friend who grew up in the States. He was like, those black folks, they do something. And it was a reference to, a young woman who had kind of walked by, and, she was black, and, she looked good. She was a good-looking sister, and just like that just really rubbed me the wrong way. And like before I could even say anything, my friend who's Egyptian, grew up in the States, he chomped them off in Arabic, but it was, Yeah, there's just a lot of things. But at the same time, I have to say that there were a lot of Egyptians, light, you know, light as well as dark, who identify with African Americans, who identify with Black Africans. It's not a neat little picture of racist society at any point.
It can't.
So that's
be.
Why, you know, I tend to say the whole Afrabia thing, there are challenges and opportunities. You know, there's definitely racism there, and it's the Ouroboros' dirty little secret. But at the same time, you know, you see a lot of, you know, Africans going to Egypt, going to Morocco, going to the Emirates, who are, you know, businessmen, who are students, who get a lot of opportunity that they can't get in their home countries and can't get in the West. They can't come to America. They can't come to Canada. They can't go to France. So they go to these Arab countries and they get decent education, and they go home and are meaningful agents of change and progress.
And you said that you were living kind of well there. You said you had servants. And describe your lifestyle in Egypt.
Well, I wouldn't say I had servants. not at all. I had a house cleaner who she would come, you know, once every 2 weeks. I had friends who would have someone come clean, you know, once or twice a week. But I would just have, you know, a cleaner once a week. I had a doorman in my building. You know, if you wanted anything, everything is available in Cairo by delivery. You know, it was very...
New York.
It can be very... Yeah, I've never lived in New York, so I don't quite know how that is. But, you know, it's a major metropolis. So a lot of the amenities you'll find in any major city. But,
is it still good for African Americans to go there? You were talking about how you felt a little guilty sometimes about how the people from other countries were treated in Egypt because you enjoyed a higher lifestyle.
Yeah, to the first point about going there, I think it's a great idea to go there for short or long term stay, even in the midst of this, you know, revolution. I think people, you'll see an incredible resilience. You know, what I know of Egypt is that, I'm talking to friends, is that they are building right now. They're trying to create a very strong country. And they need, you know, us to come. They need everyone to come and to contribute to its economy. At the same time, sure, there are a lot of, you know, safety concerns to be aware of, but, you know, Egyptians aren't violent people. They aren't dangerous people. The crime is very little. You know, I know people who would walk through the worst of neighborhoods at 2 a.m., and you would feel perfectly safe, you know. A friend of mine was telling me a story. He had left cameras, like the really nice Canon professional quality cameras.
Wow.
He had left it in a taxi. He had forgotten it in a taxi, and he had kind of walked away, and he was a couple blocks away, and he forgot they left the camera. Do you know that the taxi man was driving around looking for him? When
wow.
he saw him, he got out of the taxi, ran up and gave it to him.
I love it.
You know,
I love it.
So it's a different
world. What do you think is going to happen in the future? What do you think is going to happen in the future?
Well,
with Egypt and Egypt?
So right now the military has taken control, and in most circumstances, the idea of a military coup doesn't bode well for a country's immediate future.
Right.
But at the same time, when it comes to Egypt, you know, it's not necessarily a bad departure from what's been going on. But it's true that in many ways, it's not a departure, because Mubarak himself was a military leader. And the country has been under more or less martial law since not just Mubarak, but under Anwar Sadat, under Gamal Abdel Nasser. So Egypt has a very long way to go, and from the communiques that the military council is putting out, they're kind of limiting any more protests, any more worker strikes, and so that's worrisome. But what they're saying is that within elections will come up in the next 6 months, and I just hope that the civil society, the opposition groups will be able to organize and put up some type of showing within these next 6 months. So it's going to be hard because civil society has been repressed for a very long time.
We're speaking with Wendell Hassan Marsh. He's based in D.C., freelance journalist specializing in Africa and the Middle East. And we're talking about Egypt and what may happen there. I remember the elation we felt back during the Barack Obama election days. And since then, it has been this just pounding away at whatever alliances were formed and constant criticism and constant, you know, the whole Tea Party thing and all that. And it just has degraded into something that's just not good. And I just would hate that Egypt might have that same future, you know, this elation, we're past this, you know, and then you look up and things may not have changed. In one of the articles, you said that there are a lot of taxi drivers with PhDs, and that's going on here, too.
Right. No, absolutely. The really, if you look at the conditions in America, are very similar. A major driving force behind this uprising were, I'm hesitant to say youth, I mean relative youth, but people who are maybe 35 and under, but who are college educated, who are, you know, unemployed and have little prospects of future. You know, they can't get married. They're very restless. And so there's been a big drive behind that. And a lot of the numbers are very similar here in the U.S. So it is, it's interesting to see what's going to happen there and what happens when there's a surge of hope and then fractions within certain movements start to develop. And Egypt is definitely under threat of that. But I think and I hope that considering the past, you know, recent history of the Middle East, of Egypt under dictators, they feel so, they have not experienced anything like this in a very long time. And I think that they're going to hold on to it and they're not going to let it go. Because this is the largest break in, you know, the Middle East status quo in maybe two or three lifetimes.
But you're heartened by all this going on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm heartened and I'm hopeful. And I really hope that, you know, we as Americans can take some lessons here. Because I think there are many lessons to learn. I think that that we kind of wake up and realize that, one, that our support of authoritarian regimes who aren't democratic at all is the cause of a lot of resentment that, you know, these, you know, terrorists and other people who are against us, you know, it's based on that. It's that we support people who don't agree with our ideals, but yet we support them because they go along with our interests. And so I think that's one of the biggest lessons. You know, another lesson is just about providing social services and economic opportunity and how important that is for society. You know, and I think right now, like I said, I've been away for a long time, but definitely been in touch with popular press. But I think America is definitely at a point where we have to do a lot of soul searching, a lot of introspection about where we're going and what type of society we want. And, you know, if we don't ask these questions, you'll see these types of large upheavals. That's just human nature.
I have a feeling it's going to happen all over the world. But I'd like to thank you so much for responding to my call, and hopefully again in the future we could talk about, you know, those things that you've come up with, and how much did you learn when it came to learning Arabic, and what did it show you when you read the teachings and all that. I mean, there's so many questions I have for Wendell Hassan Marsh. I'm proud of you. I'm glad that you're using your education to your advantage, and that you're looking at the world as your home. So enjoy your time in Washington, D.C., and we can't wait to see what happens next for Wendell Hassan Marsh.
Right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much
for being with us. All right. So
bye-bye.
Go to SundayMorningLive.net, and you have there, I put a number of links there that you can go to his website. You can go to some articles that were written about him. Very interesting young man, 23 years old, just recently left Egypt. So coming up after this quick interlude, we will speak with Coach Johnny Lynn. He's just been appointed to the Philadelphia Eagles.
Hi, this is Attorney Jai Person Lynn, and you're checking in on Sunday Morning Live on Blog Talk Radio.
This morning on Sunday Morning Live, we are so pleased to have with us Johnny Lynn. He is the cornerback coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. He just got that position, but we've known him for years and years because he's a family member of my husband, Dr. Kwaku Person Lynn. So we wanted to get some inside story on him as he developed himself from a little boy to now being a coach with the Philadelphia Eagles, which I have to reveal is my favorite team right now. So, Johnny Lynn, first of all, congratulations on your new position. You haven't even started yet, have you?
Yeah, it's been a week now.
Oh, okay, so 1 week on the job. So let's go from the beginning all the way through. We're in Pasadena, and this is where you were born and raised?
Well, I was born in the city.
Uh-huh.
And raised here in Pasadena.
Okay.
And now I live in Altadena, I guess. But yes.
In what high school?
John Muir.
So you were a standout at John Muir, played football there?
I was all right.
Yeah. Just all right?
Yeah, just all right. I mean, I don't kind of talk about myself what I did, but I'm all right.
But UCLA must have thought you were okay if they brought you on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. After I left Muir,
mm-hmm.
I went to UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I went on a baseball, football scholarship, both.
Oh.
And so then ended up just playing football.
So why not golf? Your father is an avid golfer.
He didn't get into that till later life. But no, it was just something that I guess I did pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I was a better baseball player than I was a football player.
Mm.
And then it worked out that I ended up specializing in football, which is outstanding. I was there at UCLA for 4 years, lettered all 4 years, and played all 4 years, so that's pretty good, I guess.
Did you have any highlights in those 4 years?
No, I guess the biggest highlight, my freshman year, we had beat SC and we were able to play in the Rose Bowl, and that's where we played our home games as high school at the Rose Bowl. And so that was good. We played Ohio State that year and we beat them. So that's probably the biggest thing. You get to go back home, and I made the first tackle of the game, and, you know, it was exciting.
And what position was that you played?
I played corner, and I played safety at UCLA, played both.
Okay, so then from there, UCLA, did you go straight into the pros, or how did that work?
Yeah, I was drafted by the Jets in the fourth round in the 1979 draft and played there for 8 years.
So the New York Jets, a California boy, goes to the cold New York. How was that?
It was good. It was exciting. I mean, it was a change. But at that time, my objective was I didn't think I was going to get drafted. You know, I was just saying, hey, I'm just going to finish school, and I was fortunate enough to get drafted by them, and I played for them for, 8 years, and it was great. I mean, it was a great start on life.
So you started with the Jets. Where did you go from there?
Was it the Jets, and then what did I end up doing? I went to the University of Arizona and coached there for 7 years under Dick Tomey. He was the head coach, and he also had coached me in college. He was at UCLA my freshman and sophomore year. So he's kind of like my football dad. and so he got the head coaching job in 87, and we always talk. He says, well, what are you going to do now? Because that year I had injured my knee, and that was at the end of the year. And I said, well, I'd like to try coaching. So he gave me an opportunity to come down there, and I was a graduate assistant for it for 6 months.
You know, one thing we went over really quickly, you're one of seven young men and women?
Yeah, I got seven brothers and sisters.
Okay. Oh, you have seven, so there's eight of you.
Well, one had passed, but there's seven living. I mean, there was more, but that's what we have.
So with all those people around you, all those siblings around you, was coaching something that came naturally?
No. No, I talk. That's probably about it. But, no, as far as the coaching part of it, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I got my degree from UCLA, I got a history degree, but I didn't know what I was going to do as far as what I was going to do in life.
A history degree? I never thought of you as a historian.
No, I don't either, but I can get A's and B's if you want to know what I know. All that multiple guests of sociology and psychology, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
But I could write an essay, and that's the way it works.
So we're in collegiate football. How did you go to the pros?
Well, I got drafted.
No, yeah. From coaching.
Oh, as far as the coaching. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was there for 7 years and then had an opportunity to go to Tampa Bay with Sam Weiss. There was a job opening there. And at Arizona, you have different responsibilities. I coached the secondary there, but I was also the pro liaison. When the pro coaches came in, when the scouts came in, they would come to me and I would talk about the personnel that we had in Arizona and things like that. And one of the guys came in and says, well, Johnny, you know we got a job here, a job opening here. I said, well, I didn't know that. He says, well, we would like to talk to you about it. I said, well, first you need to talk to Dick Tomey first, and then I can talk. And then so we did, and got the opportunity to go and interview with Sam Weiss, and he says, when can you let me know if you want the job? I said, well, I got to go back home and talk to the wife first.
So by this time you're married to Lori.
Yeah, got married in 1980, so we've been married 30-plus years.
Wow.
And some change, and we've been together, we've been together five more times. 36 years we've been together. She's put up with me for that long.
Yeah, she says when she met you when she was like 13, and you have three 15. Kids. Oh, 15. Okay.
Yeah, not 13. That's a little too far, but still, but she looks, if you look at her, she's a lot younger looking than I am. But yeah, we have three kids. The oldest now is 28. Ashley, she's 28, and she works for the Giants.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're counterparts. And
a lot of rivalry going back and forth?
Oh, yeah, it's a rivalry. But I was in the game for 22 years, and she gets in there for 1 year, and she has a Super Bowl ring, and I don't. So that's kind of like, yeah, the rivalry of all.
So you were with the Giants, too. Let's go back to Tampa Bay. So you were at Tampa Bay.
I'm at Tampa Bay, and I coached with Sam Weiss for 2 years there. And then I went to San Francisco where George Seifert was the head coach.
The 49ers.
And I was there for 1 year. George resigned that Christmas, like day before Christmas or after Christmas, stuff like that. So now you're looking for new employment. And then in 1997, went to the Giants, New York Giants. And so was there for 7 years and coached the secondary there for 5 years. And then for two of those, the last 2 years, I was the defensive coordinator for them.
So when you were at the Giants, is that how Ashley got her love for football and wanting to work for the Giants?
No, she did everything with me as far as I'm watching over her because of the football stuff. So when the off season came in, that was my time to watch her. So she would go to workouts with us. She would stay with me, particularly all the time. And that's baby girl. That's my baby there. The girl's the first one, so I had two other boys, but she's the one that hung around, and that was my, not obligation, but that was my love, to carry where we went. Mm-hmm. She stayed with me and stuff like that, and she wanted to get into the field of athletics and things like that, and she had her first, I guess, internship when I was there with a guy named Charles Way, who used to be our fullback at the Giants, and he became the player development guy. And so
Charles Way. Okay, I was getting ready.
Not a
Charles. Okay, okay, that was
Charles White. No way. No.
Okay.
But no, and so she got an opportunity to do that, and then well, she went to college and got her master's. I mean, she got her BA, then she got her master's, and she came back and got a job with him.
And what is she doing again?
She's player development.
Wow.
So all the guys that get drafted and all the players and stuff like that see her.
Wow.
And she helps with the transition from the college to the pros, educating life skills and things like that. That's her. She does all those kind of things.
So you're the defensive coordinator at the Giants at this point in your career.
Yeah.
And then from there, where did you go?
From there, went to Baltimore. We had like three jobs we were looking at that time, one being going to the Jets, one going to Buffalo. And then that Saturday, before I had to make my decision, Baltimore called. And the reason why I went to Baltimore is because Ashley was still in school at the time, and she was at Hampton, and Chaz was going to be at Rutgers, so that's halfway between them. So I said, hey, I'll go to Baltimore. I'm still doing the same job. At least I can get to the halfway point between the kids and still stay close. So
your coach and dad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that transition, we were there for 2 years.
At the Ravens.
At the Ravens. Mm-hmm. And then where did we end up going? Went back to San Francisco. So in 10 years, I made a full circle back to San Francisco. So 2006, I was in San Francisco until 2010, at the end of 2010 season.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was good. That was another 5 years. So 6 years I've been at San Fran total. And then just got the opportunity to be at the Philadelphia Eagles.
Isn't that something?
It's a circle.
But that's your rival, isn't it? I mean, not just rival, but somebody you played against. And how do you get it up for being somebody that you used to be so against?
Very easy. They're paying the paycheck. I mean, we're all fans,
yes.
Right? I can say I'm a Raider fan.
Yes.
I've been a Raider fan for a long time. But when I'm playing against the Raiders, we got to win.
That's right.
Got to take care of the Bills.
So is being in the NFL the way you've been, and a lot of football players go through the same thing, going from one team to the next, is it kind of like being in the Army or the Armed Services?
Oh, no. This is to be here as a player. You know, it's a selective few that get here.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're fortunate to be here and you can bounce around and stay in the league as long as you can, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The way I stay in the game is that I became a coach. I didn't know I wanted to be a coach. I mean, there was other guys that asked me, coaches asked me, hey, you ever think about coaching or something like that? And I hadn't, because I was thinking about playing. And so when I got the opportunity to go to the University of Arizona to see what coaching really is, that was great. I really attracted that was kind of my personality of when I played, I was a talker, kind of football knowledge, could see things. And so I can relay it and talk to it, and that's all coaching is just being a teacher and just talking, getting your point across and telling guys to look for this and look for that, for these tendencies and look for that tendencies, and they're all going to do this when they line up like that, and you can help yourself stay ahead of the game. And so going through finding out how to coach, learning how to coach through Dick Tomey, it grew on me.
Are players different today than when you were a player and you were a young man?
Oh, absolutely. Everything changes. I mean, life changes. Back then in the day, you used to be, hey, go run through the wall. You run through the wall. Now the guy's going to say, why? You know, why I need to run through the wall? You know, so it's different, but that's good. I mean, that's progress.
What style of coach would you say you are?
I'm very positive. I talk a lot.
Do you yell?
Oh, yeah. I lose my voice the very first day. But it's all positive. I mean, you can find some positive in everything. I'm not a cusser and things like that. I believe in treating people with respect and things like that. If you respect them, they respect you. And they'll work for you. Because as a coach, when you come in, the player wants to say, well, who is this guy? And then you say, well, he played in the league, just like you playing in the league. And he wants to say, how can he help me? And you got to show him how you can help him play and how he can help him be better. And once you do that, then you got him.
So you have to prove yourself to these young men.
Well, if you've played the game and coached in the position that you played, they'll give you that respect. And they know that you didn't learn by a book. But if you didn't play the game, you're trying to tell me how to do it. Hey, man, you can't tell me how to do this. You've never experienced this.
I was thinking about, is it Mike Tomlin? They said he never played in the NFL, and here he is a head coach.
Yeah, but he didn't play in the NFL, but he played college.
Okay.
He played the ball. So there's guys that are in the game that have learned through books or something like that, and or didn't go and take time to go through college and things like that. They got the opportunity to come in and coach. Well, I'm not saying that they're not good coaches or anything like that, but like I said, for me, I had to learn how to coach.
How important is that Super Bowl ring?
It's just a thing that says that you win. What happens is everybody else in the leagues are losers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you don't get the ring, you're a loser. Even though your record might have been 14-2, if you don't get the ring that year, there's only one rose, one prize, and it's something good to shoot for. So everybody wants to get there and get that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really the money that comes with it. It's just to have the ring, to say you've accomplished something by doing that.
Money comes with rings?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
So now you're with Philadelphia, and I thought they were going to at least get to the big dance. I don't know. I was just, you know, a fan. But something happened, and it didn't go that way. I mean, they were cooking with gas, so Philadelphia has a chance this year?
They have a chance every year. They've been in the playoffs for the last 12 out of 13 years. And with Mike Vick, that's only going to be better because now he'll get training camp and get all those things. So it's going to be great.
Do you know Michael Vick?
Only to compete against him. Only to try and stop him. I mean, I think, I'm just trying to think. We played him last year when I was at the 49ers and they beat us. But he didn't play. He was out that game.
Right.
And I think we played against him when he was in Atlanta, early one of those years. I can't remember if we won or lost, but basically just going against him. Mm-hmm. I don't know him personally.
What about Andy Reid?
Didn't know Andy, even though he's from John Marshall here in L.A. I didn't know Andy. I knew some of the other coaches that are on the staff and things like that, and they knew, well, he knew of me, but we didn't know each other personally and things like that, so we got a chance to talk, and that's really a good thing.
Okay, now Andy Reid, head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, and of course Michael Vick is the quarterback or the starting quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles, and you got quite a team over there, but your job is the cornerbacks. Tell me who are the standouts there?
Well, one for sure is Shante Samuels. He's been a pro bowler. He started in New England, and now he's here at Philadelphia. He's been in Philadelphia, I want to say, about 3 or 4 years. And he's been to the Pro Bowl here, and he's going, well, he went this year again, so he's a very good, outstanding player. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to have outstanding players. It makes you a good coach.
It makes you look good, huh? All right. With all this we've been talking about and all this promise and this hope, there's a chance we might not have a season this year. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, sooner or later, they'll make their decision between the players and the owners, and they'll come to some decision. When, we don't know.
Have you ever seen us not have a season? Has that ever happened before?
Yeah, well, there's been a couple of strikes. The 1980 strike.
The whole season?
Not the whole season, but half of it.
Okay.
And so, I mean, at that time, the season was started 8 games, and then walked out for 56 days, and then resumed the season after that. But that was good. I mean, that was... At that time, it needed to happen. Some things needed to happen, and it happened good for players and for the owners. And so it set some guidelines and some boundaries on the way things need to be done. And you haven't had too many more strikes after that. I think they tried one maybe in 87 or something like that, but it wasn't successful. But the one in 80 or 82, it was 82. Yeah. For the players, it was outstanding.
So this might be a necessary evil, but you think they might be able to work out their problems? We'll have football this year?
Well, I hope they'll work out their problems. Is, you know, we want ball. Coaches want to play. Owners want to play. Players want to play. It's just a matter of just sitting down and really, you know, hammering it out.
I'm surprised to hear they get paid anyway, whether they play or not.
Well, depending on who you're talking about, play.
Oh.
The season's not started. They get paid to play right now 16 games.
Okay.
And so you're not playing any games right now, so you're not getting paid right now.
Okay.
And so once the season starts, then that's when the pay comes in. Because your preseason games, the players are on stipends. They're not on their salary.
Mm.
And so their salary begins when the season begins. And for the next 17 weeks, because there is a buy-in there, they get paid their whatever amount they make. And then for the playoff games, that comes from the league. So they don't get paid, so to speak, if they already got all their money.
Well, let's hope for the best. I want a football season this year. I want to see how I want to be able to look and see this Johnny Lynn and what he's doing. But will L.A. ever get a football team?
Well, we're hoping so.
I mean, does it even look possible?
Well, yeah. Well, they're building a stadium. I guess if you build, they shall come. But we'll see. I mean, it would love to be there. You know, then it's another opportunity. I hope it's a new team. And if it's not a new team, that brings another team closer to home. I mean, because there's a team here in L.A., I may be fortunate enough to be there.
Maybe.
But I want to stay in Philly for another 10, 12 years.
A lot of people are going through withdrawal right now. We just had the Super Bowl. Football's over for a minute anyway. What is your advice to people in the meantime and in between time?
Well, for us, well, I can't say for coaches, we're in it full time. We're not off of it. When we go next week, we go to the Combine in Indianapolis, and we'll look at all the new rookies prospects. The college seniors that are working out, and some juniors, and we're still in football. But for the rest of the people, well, it might be a long wait. We'll see the long off season, which we hope not.
Lastly, what is your advice to young men who want to get into the NFL? They're in high school. I know the chances are slim.
They're slim, but the biggest thing is go to class. don't shoot yourself in the foot by not going to class, because if you go to class, you can give yourself a chance to go to college. And once you go to college, then you have a chance to get to the pros, because there's no other way to get there. You have to play in high school, you got to play in college, and then a lot of things could open up. I mean, you can go to Canada and play a little bit if you're not at that time good enough to be in the NFL, and then just play your best, do your best. And if you do your best, you might have an opportunity to go do something else. And in that sense, the coaches in the NFL, the scouts in the NFL, they're looking for best players. And you might mature and be that best player. And they might come knocking on your door and say, hey, we got an opportunity for you. And that's all we all look for, is opportunity.
All right. Now, what haven't I asked you that you want people to know? And I think this would be a good time to mention Lori, because all that moving you've been doing, a good woman standing behind you has to be a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, without her, I wouldn't be here. I mean, that's the biggest thing. We've been, I was a senior in high school. She was a sophomore. And then we've been together this long, and she's a real football player. She understands the game. She can talk the game. And she's been around the game. And plus, being a coach, you hate to say it, but you're going to move around a little bit. And so, like now, I've got to move from San Francisco out to Philadelphia. And who's going to be doing that? Lori's going to be doing that. So she's moved a lot. And that's been, I don't want to say she's my assistant, but she's hey, she's my head coach, I'll tell you that. So
I'm going to say, yes, you went from assistant to head coach. Thank you very much, Johnny Lynn, for speaking with us at Sunday Morning Live.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Sunday Morning Live.
We're so glad to have Darlene Donlow back with us this week. She had a week off, and we have to take care of some old business, Darlene, before you get into your new report. You said you wanted to talk about the Oscars, which are coming up on February 27th, right?
Oh, yeah, but you know what? I decided to do that closer to the actual Oscar.
Okay, works for me, works for me. Okay. We are so glad to have Darlene Donlow back with us this week. She had a week off, and we have to take care of some old business, Darlene, before you get into your new report. You said you wanted to talk about the Oscars, which are coming up on February 27th, right?
Oh, yeah, but you know what? I decided to do that closer to the actual Oscar.
Okay, works for me, works for me. Okay, now I also have to ask you, today is the Grammys. And
yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's the 53rd annual Grammy Awards.
L.A. is hopping. They're having pre-parties and parties and after-parties. So are you all up in the mix?
Oh, my goodness. There were so many parties today. There are parties tomorrow. There were parties last night. Good grief. This city is just abuzz with Grammy everything. But, you know, that's a good thing. Everybody likes a good party. So, you know, that's a really good thing. But the show is tonight, actually. Tonight at 8 o'clock on CBS.
And, wow, so who are the big names that we can expect to see? Do you know anybody?
Well, I can tell you who has most of the nominations. Eminem has 10.
Wow.
Yeah. Bruno Mars has 7. Jay-Z has 6. John Legend has 5. Drake and CeeLo Green and Rihanna each have 4 nominations. So that's going to be a pretty... That's tight, actually, because, you know, the people I named, some of them are in the same category. So that's going to be exciting to see who pulls that out. And it's going to be real exciting just to see how many Eminem walks away with since he has 10 nominations.
I hear there's going to be 108 awards, but they're only going to award 10 during the show so they can concentrate on the music.
Oh, yeah, of course, because if, you know what, if they did every Grammy, I mean, you know, because they get into technical stuff, they get into, and, you know, to be honest, most people don't care about the classical music, most people don't care about the alternative music, which really, you know, isn't fair. They should get their, you know, their spot in the sun as well, but most people want to see country, pop, R&B, jazz, you know, those are the main categories. So the other categories pretty much get, you know, left by the wayside, which is kind of, you know, unfair, but what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? I have a picture of you and Vivica Fox on the SundayMorningLive.net. What's that about?
Well, I ran into Miss Vivica Fox one day, and she was looking marvelous. And, you know, just real excited. She's getting married later on this year, and she's going to be, was, I guess, that's, is that considered bi-coastal? Not really, but anyway, she's going to be, she's going to be living in Atlanta part of the time and living here part of the time. So, you know, she's ecstatic, and I wished her all the best. And
she looks beautiful. You look beautiful, too. But she just looks stunning. And how much younger is the guy she's married?
You know what? He's in his 20s and she's 47.
What?
I ain't mad at her. I'm like, hey, you know.
Okay. Hey.
Love, you know, love doesn't really care how old you are, I guess.
People marry folks the right age and they still get divorced after a while. So, hey, let her
Thank
have her, her however many years it'll be if it lasts forever. Let her have
yep.
a good time with
you. Yep, you know.
Then I saw you with this guy all wrapped and draped around you.
Well, you know, there's so many of those. You have really got to be more specific.
This
you know?
One, was it J.B. Smoove or what's his name?
Yes, J.B. Smoove is in the new movie called Hall Pass with Owen Wilson.
Okay.
And that's going to open on the 25th of February. So actually, I'll be talking about that next week. But yeah. So I went and interviewed him yesterday, and he's a very funny guy, very funny guy. And the whole premise of the movie is really kind of funny. But anyway, yeah, I'll talk about him and Hall Pass next Sunday. But yes, yes, you know, everyone has to show Darlene the love, so we know we had to.
All right, so I'm going to let you get to your report. I had to get these things because, you know, it's been so long, and all these things were piling up.
Yes, yes. But you know what else is happening this week? The gospel music greats Shirley Caesar and Commission, they're going to be honored at the BMI Trailblazers of Gospel Music Awards. Now, the show was already taped. It was taped in Nashville on January 4th, but it's going to air on the 19th of February at 7 o'clock Eastern Time, and it's only exclusively on the Gospel Music Channel. So you have to have cable to see the show. But trust me, you are going to want to see this show because it's going to be hosted by Donnie McClurkin and Kim Burrell, and it's going to feature performances by B.B. and C.C. Winans, Ledisi, Lucinda Moore, Beverly Crawford, Minna Standard, the Clark Sisters, and Marvin Sapp with the Soul Seekers. This is going to be a good show. So if you have cable, turn it to the Gospel Music Channel and watch that show. It should be absolutely fabulous.
Ledisi just performed right here at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza on Thursday night. She and Rachelle Farrell.
Did you see it?
Leroy went, and he posted a clip, and I'm going to post the link to it on SundayMorningLive.net.
So, first of all, I must say you can't be real disappointed if you see Ledisi and Rachelle Farrell. Although, you know, it was supposed to be El DeBarge.
What? What happened?
He had to cancel.
Oh, okay. Well, he's in big demand right now. They're pulling at him and pushing at him. I'm like,
yeah.
Please, don't drive this man crazy.
Yeah, so he had to cancel. So those two stepped in. And that's not bad to have Ledisi and Rachelle Farrell. That's doing pretty good.
Free at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza. I understand that was the last concert for the season.
Oh, it was?
So I can't wait till the next season. That's what Leroy Hamilton, photographer extraordinaire, reported. Yes.
And you know if Leroy says it, it's the
truth. If you ever want to go to his blog, it's photographybyhamilton.tumblr. Tumblr has no E in it, .com. All right. Go on, Arlene. I'm just all in your entertainment report. Please forgive me.
No. It's good. But you know what I have got to talk about? I have got to get props to this new movie called Muslim.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I want everyone to go out and see Muslim. It opened last Friday, and it's in limited release.
Yes. We couldn't find the closest one was in Covina.
I was just getting ready to say the only one I know is the AMC Covina here anywhere near Los Angeles.
Cool.
which I think is totally unfair because this movie needs to be seen. It is so powerful. It is extremely powerful. Anyway, it's out in theaters as we speak. It has great acting, directing, and it has a timely subject matter.
Yes.
It's about this teenager named Tariq. He's a Muslim American, and he's played by Evan Ross. Do you know who Evan Ross is?
No.
Evan Ross is the son of Diana Ross.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And he is just becoming a phenomenal actor. Did you see that movie Pride with Terrence Howard?
Yes, the swimming movie.
Yes, he was in that movie. He was the kind of meek little kid at first, but then got stronger and was the one who, like, you know, brought it home when they had to swim for the championship.
Okay.
But anyway, so Evan is playing this character named Tariq, who is struggling with his faith and identity. So when he becomes a college freshman, you know, he goes away and he uses the chance to forget about his Muslim roots. And, of course, you know, his father, who was played by Roger Guinevere Smith, is not happy about that.
We just saw him the other day. Yes.
Yes, yes. So, anyway, you know, Tariq is going through this angst, you know, about his faith and about his family and the whole bit. But, anyway, he's challenged by these racial crimes that happened that were fueled by the 9/11 situation. So anyway, the film stars like Nia Long, who plays Evan Ross's mother in the movie. I already told you Roger Guinevere Smith, a guy named Dorian Missick, who is really good. He's on that show, The Cape, right now. It also has Danny Glover. And what is interesting is this is a semi-autobiographical movie written and directed by the Kasim Bazir. This is a brother who is from Michigan, who actually grew up a Muslim, and actually went through a lot of the stuff that is in the movie. So I think, you know, you write what you know. You know, mm-hmm. you direct what you know.
Well, how far is it to Covina, daggone it? I'm going to just have to go.
Well, you know what? From you know, from L.A. proper, you can get to Covina in 30 minutes.
Okay.
You know, but I think that everyone should go out and support this film. It is really good. Like I said, it has really good acting, really powerful subject matter. And I really, you know, we should show this brother some love and go out and support this film. If we can do, you know, if we can go out and support these other, you know, mainstream films, we can support our own films as well.
I'm going to try to post a trailer to it, but it's MOOZ-LUM, right?
Right.
So when you're looking it up on Fandango, Muslim, that's the name of the film.
Exactly. Excellent, excellent movie.
And I love Roger Guinevere Smith, so anything he's in, I want to see.
Yeah, because you know Roger can be very intense.
Ooh, yes.
So, just a couple other items. I just found out that Fantasia is set to play Mahalia Jackson.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
I think she'd do very well playing Mahalia Jackson.
Better than Halle Berry and Aretha, yes. So, when is this Mahalia Jackson? Is it a film? When is it due out?
Yeah, it's a biopic. They're going to start shooting it later this spring. But anyway, I think that would be actually a good match. You know, it really works when you can have the person who can actually sing as opposed to, you know, lip syncing. You know, Fantasia can blow, so that might work, her playing the queen of gospel.
Okay.
I think it would be good. Now, another thing that's happening this week, since we're talking about movies, the Pan-African Film Festival is opening on Wednesday.
Really? Wednesday? Is he already?
Can you believe that? February 16th.
Well, you had Nate Parker on. We had him on 2 weeks in a row, actually.
Yes.
And he is the, spokesperson this year, the celebrity spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
So the 16th. And do you have the address of that film, the theater where they have the Pan-African down in Culver City?
You know what? I don't have the address, but it's called the Culver Plaza.
And if you go to PAFF.org, PAFF.org, then you can get all the information and everything. Wow, it's Wednesday, man.
Can you
so
believe
glad
that?
You said that. I am so. Think about it. It's the Grammy Sunday, Valentine's Day Monday, the Pan African opens on Wednesday, and then we have NBA All-Star Weekend. Thursday night, I'm going to see Trevor Ariza, he's having a foundation, his Trevor Ariza Foundation, he's having a pre-NBA All-Star weekend party over at the new Buffalo Wild Wings on that Thursday. And then on Sunday, I'm going to Carmelo Anthony's luncheon or you know, for Carmelo Cares on that same day of the NBA All-Star game. So,
wow.
Isn't that a lot going on?
This is a busy month. And, you know what? Felicia Rashad is going to get the Lifetime Achievement Award.
At the Pan-African opening?
Yeah, not on the opening. She's going to get it on Thursday, February 17th. But that ceremony is going to be at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center.
Okay. And all this is at PATH.org, right?
Yes.
And she deserves that totally.
Yeah, and you know what is interesting? Okay, she's getting it at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center, but you know she is also getting ready to start rehearsals for A Raisin in the Sun,
right?
Which will be at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's a wonderful tie-in for her. She deserves it. You know, it's going to be really good for her. You know, she won a Tony for playing the lead in A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway.
Right. Yeah,
you know, and I guess to this day she still is the first African-American actress to win the Tony for Best Performance by a Leading Actress in a Play.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's for A Raisin in the Sun, which she's now going to direct. So kudos to Felicia. Serious.
Felicia. Wow.
So Pan-African Film Festival, folks, is going to be the 16th to the 23rd at the Culver Plaza Theater in Culver City.
Well, last year they had the Panther film that was all the rave. I wonder what it'll be this year. Do you know?
No, I don't know. But, you know, last year was just incredible, wasn't
it?
That one got so much mileage.
And I like what Ava DuVernay is doing with her, what is it called, Affirmed? No, with her effort to try to, because, you know, she was saying these black films really depend on these film festivals, and a lot of people don't go to them because they think it's industry or whatever, and they don't realize how desperately they're needed to attend these film festivals. But she put together, I think it's called Affirmed, or some word has, you know, stands for it. There's a whole article. If you go to theatlantapost.com, there's an article on the front. It's in the Black Enterprise. But she's basically trying to get all the film festivals across the country together so that when a film opens, it's like a first-run movie. It opens in all the festivals. And I thought that was an excellent idea. So you guys can Google that and read up on it. But she has the movie I Will Follow. And that will be in the Pan-African, right?
Yes, it will.
Okay. She might be the hit this year. She might be
Let's hope so.
Well, thank you so much, Darlene Dunlow. We appreciate all the things that you've done. When you see Nate Parker, if you get to the Pan-African before I do, give him the greetings and tell him we have surely enjoyed playing his interviews here on Sunday Morning Live. So thanks again, Darlene.
All right, everybody, have a good day. Watch the Grammys.
Yes.
Hi, this is Attorney Jai Person Lin, and you're checking in on Sunday Morning Live on Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Sunday Morning Live. I'm Isidra Person Lin, and the next guest I have is somebody that I met on one of my new favorite play toys on the computer. It's called CinchCast, or Cinch. I have my iPhone. You know, download the app. I believe it's for Android, too. And, you know, if you go to the App Store, it's just Cinch. But if you go online, go to cinchcast.com. And there's this whole community of people who like to upload audio interviews, audio feeds. And this one gentleman, Elgin Bowling, was giving a whole tutorial on how to draw a caricature, of all things, a caricature, almost perfectly every time. And when I started listening to him, first of all, I liked the sound of his voice, but also he was very straightforward, and then he had a companion blog where you could go to it as well and see some of his artwork, and that just gives you even more confidence in what he's saying. So good morning, Elgin Bowling. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I think I'm going to make it, me and Ms. Cole, but you're a professional caricature artist.
I'm a professional caricature entertainer. There is a difference.
Yes, there is. What is the difference?
Okay, let me tell you the difference. You know, and I didn't mean to jump on you or make it seem like that. I do appreciate the call. I live in New York City, the Big Apple, which is a big frozen apple now because Jack Frost and Frosty the Snowman are fighting to the death here. And we are just getting plenty of snow, plenty of exercise. I'm telling you, by spring I'm going to have, you know, a six-pack. But that's another blog. That's another story. A caricature entertainer. Is a person who not only that's my microwave in the background. Not only I'm feeding my dog here. Yeah, say hello, Butchie. Anyway, a caricature entertainer is a person who provides total entertainment for his clients.
Total entertainment.
Let me explain what that is. I work in New York City as one of New York's most sought after caricature artists, and the reason for that is. Most caricature artists, not to hate on them, I'm not hating, but I've been doing this since 1990, and I've noticed that most people, when they get drawn by a caricature artist, they have to sit perfectly still, they have to stare at the caricature artist and do that one socially unacceptable thing of staring at a total stranger for a few minutes. The end result is usually a plastic-looking picture.
Oh,
it's a likeness, all right, sometimes, but most of the times it looks stiff and it looks boring. They hand it to the person and they go on to the next person. What I do, in contrast, is I engage people in conversation. I entertain. I sing. I can sing now.
Mm-hmm.
I also dance, you know, which I have a background, you know, in dance. I like, I concentrate these days on doing, you know, hip-hop dance, old-school electric boogaloo, you know, some break dance, and no spinning around on my head, but just popping and locking and just really making the whole party one big social event because that's why I'm there. So, you know, that's the difference between just having someone to draw your picture and having someone to entertain you.
Wow, that sounds great. Are you on YouTube somewhere where we can see this?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely on YouTube. If you go on YouTube.
Well, first, can we start at your blog? Because it's probably a link from your blog, right?
Okay. All right, yeah. Let's talk about my blog. The name of my blog is called The Subway Surfer Blog, and it's located at www.subwaysurfer.blogspot.com.
I'm going there now.
Let me tell you, let me repeat that again because I might be talking too fast. That's www.subwaysurfer.blogspot.com.
And there he is, folks.
Yeah, it's in my handsome face. Well, it's passable. The Subway Surfer blog started in 2000 and, what was it? About 2006. I always, let me just tell you, the stuff that you're going to see on there, it's great artwork, but it wasn't always that way.
Oh.
I used to be really terrible at caricature. Really terrible. Well, not awful, but just passable. You know, it would kind of be a likeness, but kind of not. And then you color the hair in, and if they see it as blonde, and they're a blonde, they think it looks like them. That's an old caricature trick.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I was unsatisfied with it. So what I started doing... It was likened to a pitcher when he warms up in a bullpen before the big game.
Right.
When he throws a couple of pitches or when a boxer shadow boxes, you know, in his dressing room before going in to fight in the ring. Well, I figured, since I'm traveling on the subways of New York City and sometimes on the Long Island Railroad to my gigs, you know, these were like 2 and 3 hour rides, some of them. And so I just started drawing the passengers, you know, just as a method to warm up. Well, as a result, I got pretty good, at drawing quickly. I'll take a breath so you can ask me a question.
Well, I'm looking at your Jack LaLanne. You said we're going to miss you, and that's the old Jack LaLanne that I grew up with that we remember back in the day.
Yeah.
You have some wonderful pictures on here. A lot of people have them on their walls at home, and you look at them and say, oh, that looks nothing like you. You know, they got it at the beach somewhere or whatever. But you really do, and I love the way that you use color. We don't have a whole lot of time for this segment, so what I want to do is, I thought maybe the reason I wanted to go to your blog first is that you would have a link to one of your YouTube videos from this blog.
Oh, I see. Well, if you travel in, if you just go to YouTube itself,
okay,
and just either type in Belgian bowling,
And that's spelled B-O-W-L-I-N-G.
No, that's spelled B-O-L-L-I-N-G. Elgin
bowling.
Oh,
double L. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Double L. B-O-L-L-I-N-G.
Uh-huh.
Incidentally, the name Elgin stands for Lord of the Garden. That is the literal meaning of the name, and I just take that, you know, as a sign that I was put here to nurture my garden and to make things grow.
Okay.
To make things grow, you know, that is my purpose, you know, here on earth.
I'm looking at how to deal with bullies on the train by Subway Surfer.
Uh-huh.
Is that one of you dancing?
That's,
or no?
No, that particular one that you're looking at, you know, is, you know, just for fun.
Oh, okay.
You know, that
okay.
was, yeah.
I haven't found one. I really wanted to see you dancing, but I have it on mute, I'm looking at one of you, I guess you're drawing somebody, but you're sitting there, but I noticed you're doing it in like a Sharpie. You're actually drawing with a Sharpie. I have to draw with a pencil and erase half the stuff, so that's pretty good that you...
But it's the skill of the individual, you know, that drives the thing. Now, what I normally use for caricature, the best possible pens, it's something called a Tombow brush pen, you know, and a Pitt brush pen. They work very well, you know. They have a nice, a nice brush tip. You can really get some very, very smooth lines. But the Sharpie, you know, works fine too, you know. And you know, I'm the one making the line, you know, and hey, if it's not a likeness that, you know, the customer agrees with, well, it's not going to matter what type of tools you use, you know. So it's all about you having the talent.
And let's switch reels. I know that you teach or you taught art, and I'm seeing you in one video opening up a brand new iPad. Did you buy that or did you win it?
Oh, I won that.
Oh, my goodness.
This is just one of the greatest stories. I'm so, so glad you asked me that. My father and I, you know, growing up, you know, we had kind of a stormy relationship, as most fathers and sons do. So one Father's Day, I wanted to give my dad something that would be memorable, and I didn't want to give him some Old Spice heritage shave, you know, or another tie. And so I figured, well, let me give him a story of how he helped me as a kid that he might not know about. Now, this story also is, written. I'm sorry, it's on YouTube also. And it's an account of how I used to get bullied, you know, growing up, you know, growing up in Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy section of Brooklyn, you know. And, I mean, this was an everyday occurrence. I got beat up so much that I wore glasses at the time, and I had extra spare pairs of glasses just for the occasion. I'm not kidding you. I mean, literally.
Wow.
And my father got, you know, my father concerned got tired of this thing one day, and he bought me this book, you know, Bruce Tegner's Book of Self-Defense.
Uh-huh.
Well, I won't spoil the whole thing for you, but I submitted this story. It was on PowerPoint, and there was this new company coming out called AuthorStream.com. You know,
uh-huh.
And what AuthorStream does, and this is a good thing for your listeners, what AuthorStream does, it takes PowerPoint videos, you know, that you upload to their site, and it turns it into a YouTube film, you know, that you can post online. So it's an excellent, excellent promotional tool, you know, for all of those entrepreneurs out there. Again,
yeah.
It's www.authorstream.com.
Wow.
So anyway, to continue the story. I submitted this to AuthorStream because I wanted this on YouTube, and I wanted to increase my online presence and, you know, get some, you know, publicity, and it was free, you know. And so
free, yeah, that's the magic word. Free is affordable. and so I uploaded this thing. I went to bed, and I got up the next morning, you know, and checked, and this thing got close to 100 views. And wow. They sent me this email saying, congratulations, you are the third week winner for an iPod.
No, iPad. That's
said,
a big difference.
iPad.
Yes.
And I said, and you know how you get spam all the time?
Yes, right.
No way. And I was, let me tell you, I was inches away from the delete button, and I said, there might be something to this. And
yes.
So, you know, I waited, and I tell you, I didn't believe up until the time, you know, that the FedEx man handed me my iPad.
Wow.
Yes. You know,
and,
Have I been using it? You know, the iPad has revolutionized the way that I run my business. It has revolutionized the way that I do my art. I mean, it is, you can do it with just such ease. And like I said, you know, it's not the tool, it's the artist. But let me tell you, this is one heck of a great tool.
Well, you know, there is so much more I want to talk to you about. We are almost out of time for this segment. We got to find out a couple of more things about you. First of all, what is the biggest thing that you do that we need to know about that we could support you in or consume or, you know, buy one, a copy, a book or something? What do you need from
it? Well, that's a good question. If you go to if you check on my blog site, you know, at www.subwaysurfer.blogspot.com, you're going to see a link that says, you know, buy stuff in the Subway Surfer store. Now, I have some free downloadable. Yeah.
We never did explain how you got to be the Subway Surfer.
We can get to
yes.
that.
Yes.
Can you explain now?
Yeah, quickly.
Okay, quickly. Oh, yeah, wow. I'm talking so much I forgot. Okay, I warmed up. drawing people on the trains. I amassed such a large quantity of drawings that a friend of mine said, wow, these are pretty good. They're pretty hilarious in and of themselves. Why don't you, you know, make a blog, you know, about them? And to me, blogging was new for me back then. I thought it was something that only writers did. This was like 2006. And she said, yeah, you know, throw this up there, you know, and see what happens, you know. And so I tentatively started doing this. You know, I had another friend named Chris Collins, you know, a fellow caricature artist, who told me, I have a blog, you know, on WordPress. Your stuff is so good, you deserve to have a blog. And he literally, for free, just kind of put my stuff up there. So the Subway Surfer became a kind of a persona, you know, for me, the Subway Surfer, the guy who's on the train and draws the caricatures. So, because, you know, I needed a persona. I needed a secret identity like Batman. You know, that would give me permission for doing this, quote-unquote, socially unacceptable thing. I mean, I'm there, I'm drawing subway commuters, I'm staring at these people, they're watching this guy draw in the corner, and let me tell you, New Yorkers they have a variety of reactions. I'll tell you some stories on the next segment.
Yeah, we will talk again. Yes.
I had to become the Subway Surfer, which gave me permission to do what I do. And I didn't know about branding back then, but what happened as a happy accident was it became my brand.
Yes.
And unlike my fellow caricature artists, you know, who also, you know, drew, I had a brand.
Okay.
I had something that set me apart, you know, from everybody else. And I had this thing that I was known as and this thing that I did.
That's right. So, I see these little books down here when I scroll. Are you selling those?
Well, we have a couple that are for free, but there's one that I am. There are more to come. We just put that store up. You know, so those books are downloadable. Anybody can download them for free.
Wow.
You know, that's not a problem. You know, I do ask for reviews on them. You know, I ask people to spread them around. It is definitely a promotional tool to get my name out. But there's one in particular that does cost. It's a small fee.
And
you know, but you know, it's very important to me.
What's the name of it?
It's called Bonk, B-O-N-K.
I don't see that one.
That one addresses the subject of bullying. You know, I'll have that up, You know, this evening. You know.
Okay,
but,
I tell you what. Let's do this. This week there was that horrible, horrible story about the young boy in Pennsylvania somewhere, and his parents were from Liberia, and seven boys beat the living mess out of him. And luckily the people from The View, I'm sure other shows have done it, but I haven't even seen it yet. My girlfriend called me almost in tears telling me about how this story was, about how terrible this boy was beaten senseless. And on the page that she sent me the link, the police are saying, and these people, they're bullying, and this is terrible. And then the same day, I get a link for the Houston Police Department, which is beating a kid. And it's the same thing. It's like, what is going on in our world?
This bullying thing has become systemic.
It's horrible. It's
no longer just an innocent school. Well, it wasn't innocent then, but it was something in the past that we thought was just
something that happened
on the schoolyard,
yes,
and that you would grow out of it, you know, and you'd become friends later, yada, yada, yada. This thing has become systemic, and it is, you know, pervasive in our society. And even before the story that you just described, there was a young man, you know, who was filmed doing a very intimate act, you know, which he should not have been filmed doing, you know, by his roommate. The guy was so distraught, the poor man jumps off the George Washington Bridge.
He cannot live with
the shame and humiliation.
Yes.
Now that is a extreme example of cyberbullying. My heart goes out to that young man's family.
Yeah.
So anyway, getting back to the book, I feel that if we're going to nip this in the bud, we're going to have to start with the generation that's coming up now. So my book, Bonk, is written about bullying, its consequences, and its roots. It's a very short story, and it's told in a humorous kind of vein, but the story is hard-hitting.
Can we get it from Amazon.com?
Not yet, but you can get it from a site called epubbud.com.
Spell that again.
Epubbud.
Epubbud?
Yeah, epubbud.com. Yes. You just type in the name Elgin Bowling. I've got a whole series, you know, of books up there. By the time this airs, you know, I will have the link, you know, so people can download that. The book is only 99 cents. It's my hope. I want to make it affordable, you know, it's my hope that educators,
yes,
you know, would use this as a learning tool to start a dialogue,
yes,
you know, with children. You know, it's designed in such a way that it doesn't point the finger, you know, at anybody, even the bully, but it definitely will get the point across. You know, and I'm confident that it will start a dialogue on this subject because we need to be talking about this.
Someone once told me that we're all victims of victims. So even the bullies who do that, somebody did something to them to make them want to be that way. And
absolutely.
And I'm just glad you took that tack. I really enjoyed talking to you. It was just so funny how I got this cinch cast from you, and you're going on about how you too can draw a caricature and really get the raised eyebrow of the person or whatever it is, and they don't have to sit still and yada, yada, yada. I still did not see you break dance, but we are going to talk again because I love talking to you, so I'm going to interview you again. But I just want to thank you so much for being there, for answering my call today. Again, we've been speaking with Elgin Bowling. You can call him the Subway Surfer, and he has a blog at subwaysurfer.blogspot.com. If you want to email him at cartoons4u2, cartoons, the number 4, the letter U, the number 2, at AOL.com. And I really, really want to thank you, and I hope people will support him by buying 30 of these books, sharing them with a class of 30 students, and really having them all talk about this bullying thing. I'm sorry you were bullied when you were growing up, but somehow you were given the task to do these books, and maybe they'll help some of the students not have to go through that. But thanks again, Elgin Bowling, for answering the call.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Sunday Morning Live.
Greetings. This is Candid Moments, and I am Dr. Kwaku Person Lin. The United States of America is being sold primarily to countries who were formerly victims of the U.S. quicker than most realize. Walter E. Fauntroy, U.S. Congressman for the 31st District, Washington, D.C., and a member of the Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives, shares some information with us.
Money that we sent abroad in the $200 billion trade deficit a year, plus the interest on the money that we've had to borrow from the very Japanese and West Germans and English and rich of this country to finance our debt, that money is coming back in the hands of foreign investors, and they are buying America from under us. You in Los Angeles know it best. But let me tell you what we in the Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs Committee of the House have learned, and that is becoming increasingly apparent to the American people. If you don't believe it, read Fortune magazine, read Time magazine, both of which keep up with what's happening in America in this regard. You ought to know that foreign scouting parties are combing America's highways and byways, buying every profitable venture available. They're buying real estate. They're buying shopping malls. They're buying ski resorts. They're buying farmland and mineral deposits. They are Japanese scouting parties. They are West German. They are Dutch. They're English. They're French. They're West German. Let me give you just a few examples. A little more than 4 years ago, the Kobayashi Corporation of Japan purchased the Exxon building on Times Square for $610 million. They purchased the Mobil Oil Tower in Houston and the ABC and NBC headquarters in Los Angeles. Indeed, Jack Anderson, a few months ago, reported that 67% of downtown Los Angeles is owned by foreign investors. Indeed, the Japanese now own a third of the seafood packing industry in Alaska, 70% of Hawaii. Missed it on December 7, 1941, but got it because of the fact that our economy is shaped by the linkage of our financial system with a system of global capital markets, international institutions, and relationships that seek to maximize profit, quite without regard to national boundaries. The Japanese have 67 companies in a place called Tennessee. Not long ago, after purchasing the next to last tire company owned by Americans, Firestone, they moved the headquarters from Southern California to Nashville, Tennessee. Tennessee, where they've opened a Nissan factory in a place called Smyrna, Tennessee. Not Detroit, Michigan, where you know who lives and where you know where factory space has gone fallow, but in Smyrna, Tennessee, to make Nissan cars. Then down in Blytheville, Arkansas, about 50 miles away, they've opened a steel factory. Not going to make Nissan cars with U.S. steel. When we can put Uncle Bubba to work, Archie and Edith, safely away from them, you know who, making the steel, and then opened the Bridgestone Tire Company, which acquired Firestone. So they're making Nissan cars with Japanese steel made in America, putting rubber on them from the Japanese Bridgestone Corporation tire company that owns Firestone now.
That was Congressman Walter E. Fauntroy of Washington, D.C., showing us how countries may lose wars to the United States, but come back later to buy it out, ultimately to control the economics, then the politics. There are many lessons to be learned here. This is Candid Moments, and I am Dr. Kwaku Person Lin. Have a great day. Odabo.
And thank you very much, Dr. Kwaku. By the way, that historical piece aired on the first generation of Sunday Morning Live 20 years ago. So when whatever he was referring to, if you're wondering, well, wait a minute, that, just remember that was 20 years ago that that piece was created, and it's African American History Month, and we're playing a number of what we call candid moments that were produced by Dr. Kwaku for the show that we had many, many years ago. We are going to go ahead through the rest of the time here. So if you'd like to call 323. That's not going to work. Call 619-996-1674. I am live. You did hear a number of pre-recorded messages from Coach Johnny Lynn of Philadelphia Eagles. Darlene Dunlow had her entertainment report, as I told you. It was chock full of information. And we did talk live to Wendell Hassan Marsh, who is a young journalist who just left Egypt, and we were talking about Egypt. And we talked to Elgin Bowling, who I recorded that a couple of weeks back when I was really in the throes of my cold. But if you'd like to talk to us now, we have time until the end of the hour. We're going all the way till noon. You can do so. You can call us at 619-996-1674. Maybe something was said to you that you would like to clarify or comment on. Or if you're in the chat room, which if you've logged on to our show, you found your way to the show, scroll down and you should see the chat room. There are a number of people in there. We'd like to welcome Yvette Moyo, who is with Real Men Cook in Chicago. She also, they have, this is so exciting, they have Yvette, don't kill me. It's a sweet potato pound cake mix that she's now marketing in stores. And I hear that is some good stuff there. So you buy that, you come home, you cook it up, you're a big hit with the family. And she said she was on her way out to hear a lecture and do some different things, but I'd like to thank her for stopping by. Green Beasley, thank you for your energy this morning. Sybil McMiller, as always, I love to thank you for being here and being part of Sunday Morning Live. We had a show with her yesterday, and we're waiting to see if her guest from yesterday will be covering the Oscars or the Grammys. You better find out quickly because the Grammys are tonight. And meanwhile, this past week, those of you who tuned in early, I said that I had a chance to go to Maverick's Flat. And those of you who are older might have partied at Maverick's Flat. It's on the Crenshaw Strip. It's a place where, in my day, it had passed the Maverick's Flat time. See, the building was created in 1937, but it didn't become Maverick's until the 60s. And it was owned by, I think his name is John Daniels. He was a black exploitation star and some other people. And it's just a lot of history in that building. There's a picture there. I don't know if you ever saw that picture. I forget what they were protesting, but it had Jim Brown and Willie Davis and all the basketball players of that time. And that meeting took place in that building. When you walk in, there's a whole gallery of pictures from the era. But they redid it. They just redid it. The only thing they did was put in a brand new elevator, and upstairs they made a beautiful restaurant with linen cloths and leather chairs. It's just first class all the way. Right here on the Crenshaw Strip, and it's open every night from 5 until, and they have live music. So if you have a birthday coming up or a special event, consider Maverick's Flat. And while we were there, we were supposed to interview one of the owners, but he was ill, so he still let us, you know, his people let us take a walk through. And I had a chance to speak to Chef Kyle, and he's a young chef. He's the head chef there, but he used to be a pastry chef. And so when I began to ask him a few little questions, this piece is only about a minute, he was telling us about what they actually cook there for desserts and prepare there, I should say. This is a high-end restaurant. And but the beginning of it, you know, some people are talking, so it might be a little bit hard to hear, but just keep listening, and you'll hopefully your mouth will water like mine did.
So what do you cook here? What can I come here to get from Maverick Flat? What are you known for?
Our menu is a contemporary Southern American.
Okay.
So it's like soul food that you're kind of familiar with, but it's turned upscale. So it's more suited for the fine dining establishment, you know, that we are.
So smothered chicken, fried chicken.
We're known for our fried chicken, our fried catfish. We have amazing crab cakes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's one of our biggest sellers, our crab cakes.
Wow.
So.
And the desserts?
Because I was, you know, trained as a pastry chef, I have an amazing dessert menu.
Wow.
So I have, what do I have? I have my peach cobbler. It's a little bit more upscale than your traditional peach cobbler. I have a crispy candied yam dessert. That's a house favorite. Warm chocolate cake. All of our ice creams are made in-house. So.
Come eat with you, huh? Thank you.
And that was Kyle. If you didn't hear what he was saying in the beginning, he was saying that the cuisine is like a high-end soul food kind of thing. They are known for their fried chicken and their fried catfish, but he said they are really known for their crab cakes, which if you're from the East, you know crab cakes, and you really can't find them that well out here. They put a lot of filler and stuff. I don't know how he prepares his, but I can't wait to go and try them. But I was really surprised when he said they made all their ice creams in-house and that hot, warm chocolate cake. I mean, it just made me want to go like today. So they have live entertainment, and most people wind up eating downstairs so they can see the show and everything. But if you do have a dinner party, you can go upstairs and request it. And if you go to mavericksflat.com, then you can get more information about this amazing place. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that to your attention. The same day I was doing some other work for another outlet and did the interview with the folks that own the Buffalo Wild Wings over there on Crenshaw. And it's two young guys in their 30s. They already own one out in Torrance. And there's TV screens everywhere you go. The place is really nice. They said they have a bar with 30 different kinds of beer on tap and a full bar with all kind of, you know, cocktails or whatever. So on Super Bowl Sunday, the place was packed. On the Lakers, anything, they say, they have a great crowd. But they don't make it so packed where you can't find a place. They let in the number of capacity, and then you could have a lot of fun. My son, Jai Person Lin, went there, and he said he really enjoyed it. So, again, I am Isidro Person Lin, and this is Sunday Morning Live. If those of you in the chat room have anything to add or would like to speak online, please give us a call. And that number is at the top of your page, 619-996-1674. And if not, then we'll just go ahead and close out the show. 2 hours is a long time to make people listen, I understand. It's just that we had things. And when I did the Egypt interview, which he just confirmed this morning, man, we went a half an hour when I really thought it would be like a 15-minute, which I don't know what I was thinking. Very interesting young guy. If you miss that part of the show, as soon as we end, it'll buffer for a little while, and then you could play it again, and you'll be able to hear what he had to say. He was a young African-American journalist he was a Fulbright fellow, and he spent 16 months in Egypt, and he has some very interesting conversation, and I would love to interview him again. And let's see what else I have. I have this switchboard loaded up with all kinds of pre-recorded things. So while I'm waiting to see if anybody does want to participate and call, I'm going to play the second part of the King Parade, which I've been promising ever since we were going to play it and ran out of time, just to give myself a breath. So here we go. This is an audio, but the actual video is on show number 13, I believe. So let's take a quick listen.
This is cool, though. This gallery is the Lemert Project.
I'm gonna see you in LA. again. I'm on tour with Kim right now. We'll be back. We're going to be doing
to the SundayMorningLive.net and just scroll down some of the previous shows, you'll see the actual video where you can get a better idea. Elder Barge came to Leimert Park and he was performing. Michelle came, and I don't know if you could hear her little, her speaking voice is this little tiny voice, but when she sings, she has this great, robust voice, kind of like Tina Marie almost, and just amazing that, you know, right here in the community for free, you just walk down the street and have all this talent and entertainment going on. It was the King Day festivities after the parade. The parade ended at the park, and so there were tons and tons of people there. A great day in L.A. It was beautiful that day, and so anyway, I had been meaning to bring it to you, but I didn't realize how hard it was to actually listen to. So as I close out the show, I do want to direct your attention to SundayMorningLive.net. On Facebook, I have a tendency to overpost, so I said, well, let me go and put everything I would post on Facebook over here at the blog. And one of the things that we found out this week, as you'll see at the top, is Magic Johnson. He is standing there with Ron Burkle. Ron Burkle, you'll know him from the supermarkets, I believe Ralph's, or anyway, he owns like tons and tons of things. And the two of them came together, put together a deal, and they bought the company that owns Vibe. So Vibe magazine. So they are now running that company. And as you know, Magic is also has his hands in this new Farmers Stadium that's coming to L.A. And so he had begun liquidating a lot of his holdings, and I think that was to get into new businesses. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But Leroy Hamilton shot this picture years ago, and so he pulled it out of his vault and shared it with me. And excuse me, if you click that link there, it'll go to his Tumblr page. And Leroy Hamilton is photographybyhamilton.tumblr.com. And you notice Tumblr has no E in it. He has so much stuff in there. I mean, you just got to go to his blog and scroll through. There's a picture of a girl that he shot just last Saturday, he was saying, for a community coalition, which they call Coco South, L.A., and this young woman was so full of energy. She was a student. I think she was a high school student. And a few days later, she got hit by a car and was killed. Just amazing. Then he writes copy next to the pictures so you'll know what's going on. So go to his blog, and we'd like to thank him for sharing pictures. So we didn't confirm our Egypt interview until this morning, so I put a number of clips up that I found, you know, from YouTube or whatever. And so if you scroll through and look at some of those, they say that the English Al Jazeera is a good way to find out more information about Egypt. And then, of course, yesterday we had a family lunch, and Johnny Lynn is a cousin of my husband's, and so all his siblings and all the first cousins were together, and so I got a chance to interview him. He was just named coach of the Eagles, and there's a picture of Kwaku and Johnny together at the lunch. And again, Darlene Dunlow, I went ahead, I think I put up the information about the gospel show that she announced, and that's her and Vivica, and Ava DuVernay's is a clip for her trailer that will be at the Pan-African Film Festival, so check out I Will Follow. And then again, Leroy Hamilton was at the Let Us See Rachel Farrell concert at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza, so if you missed it, you can get a little taste of how those two performed and what they look like in that clip there. And then, of course, Darlene talked very highly of the movie Muslim, M-O-O-Z-L-U-M, and the closest place we could find it playing is in Covina, so she said it's about a half an hour drive, so if you want to explore today, then go ahead and try to check out this film. She said it's very, very powerful. And this is the artwork of Elgin Bowling. I'm just scrolling through SundayMorningLive.net, and there's a link there underneath the Jack LaLanne caricature for Bonk, that bullying ebook. And as he said, it's only 99 cents, and you download it. You have to download a little thing for your browser so you can see it. It's an ebook. Don't think you're going to get a paper book for 99 cents. So but it's a good way to deal with the issue of bullying. And if you're working with children, I know Big Bird works with children, and, you know, bullying, you got to bring up the conversation, because even as a child, we had a kid that we used to wear him out. And then finally his mother came to the school, and she says, "Why are you guys doing this to my son?" And we didn't think about it till she brought it to our attention, and we all felt bad, and so we all started treating him right. Probably one of the reasons that he was being bullied was because they called him stinky, and why would you let your kid be called that? But anyway, that was. I hope he's doing well now. But I just remember the kids in the feeding frenzy of messing with this kid named Stinky. And so when you talk to kids, they'll understand, and maybe they'll back off, or maybe they have their own problems you can help them with. And I think that would be really, really good. There's a video of I wanted to tell you about Google Translate. Even in L.A., you will run into somebody who doesn't speak your language. So if you have this on your iPhone or your smartphone, then it actually, you say into the phone what it is, you know, like, where is the, you know, whatever. A lot of times people come to me and ask me for directions or whatever, and I say it in or I type it in, and then you could press a button and it'll speak it out loud. So if I'm in Italy and I put something in and it writes it back to me and tells me what it is, I may not feel comfortable pronouncing those Italian words that I'm not familiar with, but you press a button and it'll say it out loud. So you let the person hear it, and then you can communicate. Also, Ted Williams was back in the news. He left his rehab, and he talks about why. There's a, in case you missed that, there's a link there. And then there's a link to more of that, you know, that whole thing I talked about with the Houston police who beat the young 15-year-old kid. And so they're talking more about it. As a matter of fact, a young man is speaking in there, if you like that. And Aretha is feeling better. I know they said Jennifer Hudson's doing a tribute to her, but she was at the game with Reverend Jackson, so click there to see the picture if you missed it. This last week we had Mark Lucky, and so here's another page of tools that I found, so you can click those links there. There's so many if you do work on the Internet, there's so many tools that you will need to do the things that you have to do. This Michael Fosberg thought he was white, And he was raised by a white mother and his white stepfather. And then later on in life, I think it was like 30, he was a grown man when he found out that his actual father was black. So he said that I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, and it was as if I changed in that moment from white to black. What an amazing story that was. So you can click those links. And here's a little girl that she just belts it out at Britain's Got Talent. And when you see the trailer under it and talk and see how these girls are treated certain places around the world, you can see why it's so important that we treat our girls well. We talked about bullying, usually boys, but we got to treat our girls well as well. So here's more links for the Magic Johnson story and the vibe. And, okay, don't forget, NBA All-Star Weekend is coming up. That Thursday, the 17th, is the Trevor Ariza Foundation. They're having their event over at the Buffalo Wild Wings. It's by invitation only, so don't just – I guess you can show up and look at the yellow carpet. They call it yellow carpet because their colors are yellow and black and green or something. But and then, oh, I had the piece by MC Hammer I wanted to play. I'll have to play that next week. Daggone it. MC Hammer was at the opening, or you know how they have the big launches of the – HP has a new iPad-type device out called the TouchPad. So, and he – Robert Scoble interviewed him, and I thought that was very interesting. I wanted to bring that to you. And then I have just a few tweets that I thought were interesting, and I'd like to thank – there were a number of people that I'd like to thank for this show – Leroy Hamilton for his images, Robert Scoble, who again we'll hear next week, Coach Johnny Lynn, thank you very much, Dr. Kwaku for filming, and Elgin Bowling, Chef Kyle for Mavericks Flat, and Attorney Jai Person Lynn for recording a drop for me at the last minute. If any of you would like to record a drop and send it to me, feel free to do so. And also, if any of you would like to contribute to the show in any way, maybe you interviewed someone and you'd like to provide the audio with to us, you know, you're more than welcome, and if we approve it, we would definitely love to share it. Maybe you're a musician and you like to make bumps, and you might make bumpers and, you know, things that go in between, you know, how you're whoever you are and you're listening to with music tracks and different things like that. If you'd like to contribute those, feel free to do so. Or maybe it's just links or things that are going on in your world. Before it's all over with, we want to interview all kinds of interesting people, and maybe you're one of those interesting people and you have a story to tell. So that's pretty much it. I'm going to make one more quick check of the chat room and just see if there's anything that you'd like me to announce. Okay, she said, Yvette Moyo says, don't forget Kiss and Tell, the documentary by Daryl Pitts, nominated as the best documentary at the Pan-African Film Festival. And Yvette, we're all wondering what is going to be that film this year, and who knows, that might be it. I know Ava DuVernay's I Will Follow is in there, and I can't wait to go. When you go, you're going to meet so many people. You'll be sitting next to celebrities, just people out having a good time. So make sure you go to the Pan-African Film Festival to find out when this documentary is going to air, or be screened rather. Go to PAFF, P-A-F-F, PanAfricanFilmFestival.org. So that's PAFF.org. Okay, well, we got it all in, except the MC Hammer part. Please forgive me for that. And we will do that next week. But thank you so much for listening to Sunday Morning Live. I'm going to go in search of the movie Muslim. I'm going to take a foray into Covina. So, again, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in and for your support of the show. And Sybil McMiller, you are a trooper. Thank you so much. Talk to you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to Sunday Morning Live. We'll be back again next week at 10 a.m., so please be sure to join us and visit our show blog if you have any questions about anything you've heard at sundaymorninglive.net. Leave us a comment. And we thank you very much for listening. I'm Isidra Person Lynn.